This is Catherine Nessa with the American College of Physicians. Today is January 30th, 2008, and I'm talking to four of our women physician members about women in medicine, what they enjoy about being a woman physician, what some of their challenges are and have been, as well as other relevant issues impacting them and the profession at large. Joining me are Dr. Ruth Parker in Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Susan Thompson-Hengel in Springfield, Illinois, and Dr. Christy Reimer in Iowa City, Iowa. Thank you all for your time and for being here today. I'll start off with introductions, with each of you giving us a brief overview of what practice setting you're in, how long you've been in practice, and subspecialty, if it applies. And I'll start with Dr. Reimer.
So my name is Christy Reimer, and I am currently at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. I went to medical school in South Dakota and did a residency in Kansas, and then I stayed on as faculty as a general internist, doing both inpatient and outpatient medicine at the University of Kansas in Wichita for 5 years. I was married 2.5 years ago, and my spouse was doing a pulmonary fellowship at Iowa, and so I moved here. So for the past 3 years, I've been a hospitalist on the clinical side, and then I also work with the residency program as an associate program director.
I'm Susan Hengel, and I am a general internist at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. I went to medical school at Rush Medical College in Chicago. I did my residency training at Georgetown in Washington, D.C., and I was chief resident at Georgetown and finished that in 1997. I then went into private practice for a year in Evanston, Illinois, and I have been at SIU now for nearly 10 years. And I currently am the internal medicine clerkship director and associate residency program director. And I mainly practice in the outpatient setting with some coverage on the inpatient setting.
I'm Ruth Parker. I'm professor of medicine at Emory University School of Medicine. Joined the faculty here in 1988. I was at Chapel Hill for medical school, then University of Rochester, where I did med peds and then a chief resident year in internal medicine. And then I was a clinical scholar at Penn in general medicine. And then came here and joined the faculty in general medicine in 1988. And have a joint appointment here at Emory in the School of Public Health. And work in general medicine, mostly in the ambulatory setting, teaching, and also do a good bit of access to care, health services research on underserved populations, and primarily on health literacy.
I'm going to start with Dr. Parker. Of the three, you have the most experience. As you know, the percentage of women entering the medical field has increased significantly, especially in the last 20 years. In your opinion, is discrimination still an issue for women in the workplace?
You know, I think it's probably still there to some degree.
Has it changed since you first started out? Have you noticed a shift in any way?
I think there's definitely been a shift. I mean, I think for one thing, when I was in medical school, I was at Chapel Hill in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? When did I graduate? I can't even remember what. There you go. You can tell them all. I can't remember what year I graduated from medical school in 81. So yes, I was in medical school in the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, for one thing, the preponderance of women that are training in medical school and training, the numbers are up just enormously. And in some of the fields, they're just, you know, there's a predominance of women in many of the fields. Mm-hmm. So there's no question that the critical mass has had an impact. But we definitely don't have the kind of numbers in leadership roles at high levels within, I think, whether it be in academic medicine at dean and chair and sort of high-powered roles, all the way down into leadership of big private practice groups and multi-specialty groups. We just don't see as many women in those leadership roles.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's probably for a combination of reasons. I think some of it may have to do with what people actually want for their jobs and what they're choosing, what they aspire to. Mm-hmm. And I think for some, there probably have been barriers. There probably are some barriers that have been, you know, related to gender and to other issues. But I think for some, there may be lifestyle choices. Maybe that's not what's going on. So I think it's probably for a combination of reasons. But I think the fact that we don't see as many in the leadership roles is, you know, it's there. I mean, there's no denying that exists. It's better than it was. But I think overall, I think there's probably less of it than there was just because the critical mass is there. That'd sort of be my take on it.
Dr. Reimer, how about you?
I actually, too, feel like I've been very lucky. I have had very supportive division chiefs and department chairs and mentors, and I feel like I've had a fair chance at everything that I've wanted to do or tried to do.
Okay.
I agree that there are fewer women in leadership positions than in other places in medicine, and I think also think that that's multifactorial. So I think it's likely that at some level somewhere, although I can't give you a personal experience, that discrimination plays some role, but I also think that there are lots of other things that contribute to that, so including lifestyle choices and just the fact that only recently have medical students been nearly 50% women, and it takes a while for that class of women to rise up through the ranks.
Okay. Dr. Hingle?
I guess I would put myself in the same boat as everyone else. I feel like I'm in a very supportive environment. I don't think I could ask for a better place to work. I don't feel that my gender has been detrimental in any way as far as me achieving what my goals are. As far as the issue about women in leadership positions, I guess it depends on how you define discrimination. I think
because
in order for changes to occur, there's going to need to be more flexibility. I mean, if we want more women in leadership positions, I don't know that I would say it's lifestyle choices. I just think it's maybe redefining expectations.
Dr. Parker, what do you find rewarding about being a woman physician?
Well, I have a great job. I love my job. I don't know if it's, I have to be honest with you. I think it's because I love medicine. I love being a doctor. I went into it because I thought it'd be a great job, and I really feel like it is. I am a female who's a physician, but my patients are all types of patients, it has been for me not only. I mean, I went into medicine because I like people, I like their stories,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it would be incredibly gratifying to be able to try to learn how to help take care of people when they were sick. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
really simple, and that's what I like doing. And
right.
I like teaching around it, and I like trying to stay focused on patients and what we can do to try to help them. Mine's kind of simple. And I've always liked that, and I still like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to get back to that when things get frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
And medicine has given me enormous flexibility, which I have 4 kids and a husband who works way too much and have a lot of other passions and interests outside of practicing medicine. So it's just been incredible to be able to have the kind of flexibility to keep doing something that I really enjoy and be able to do other things.
Do you think there are any ways that women excel in medicine, maybe? Perhaps being more of an empathetic listener or anything like that? Have you experienced with your patients situations where you felt, because you're a woman that it made a difference?
I work a lot in health communication, but I have to tell you, a lot of my collaborators right now are men. But I look back on my training, and one of the things I love to laugh at myself about is when I was on call in the ER, and there used to be these women who would bring their babies in at 3 and 4 in the morning, sometimes in an ambulance, because the kids were screaming.
Right.
And I think about myself as a resident. And what I said and what I did and how I acted.
Right.
And I tried to do the best I could with what I knew and understood.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I had kids who would scream in the middle of the night.
Right.
I would look back at myself and say, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Now I know. These were great parents.
Well, speaking of having children, since you're talking about it, this is one of my other questions. We've been talking about more and more women are entering medical school. A lot of women are pursuing certain, like family medicine or pediatrics in higher numbers because they allow more freedom, perhaps, with the work-life balance. Dr. Hingle, was that a consideration for you when you were making your decision?
It actually was not. When I was making my decision, I was single and unattached and could do whatever I wanted. I do a lot of mentoring with our medical students as clerkship director and talk about this quite commonly with students. And the big thing that I emphasize to them is the need for flexibility and the need for being open to change, because things are going to change frequently throughout the course of your life, and that you have to be open to that. And you should be picking something based on something that you really enjoy doing, because you have a long career. You know, when you're choosing college or medical school or residency, you think 3 or 4 or 5 years is a long time. But when you think about doing something for 30 years, that's a very long time. So
right.
You should really pick something that you feel passionate about, because the other stuff works itself out.
Mm-hmm.
I did get married, and I do have 2 kids, and we have tried all sorts of different arrangements. Initially, both my husband and I were working full-time, and it didn't work out for us. I tried to go part-time.
Right.
That didn't work out for me, just for a lot of reasons. And now my husband stays at home with both of our kids, and that's worked out for us currently. And so I just sort of emphasize you need to pick something based on what you're passionate about, not because of lifestyle, because all the lifestyle stuff, you work it out as long as you're open to change.
Okay. Dr. Reimer?
Pursuing a career that's flexible. And so particularly the question about entering family medicine or pediatrics, that didn't cross my mind either, because I, for the same reasons, really liked internal medicine. I liked adult medicine, and I feel like I've made a good choice. So my family situation is that I have a 16-month-old who, interestingly, was up all night screaming with a temp of 103.6 last night. So I can relate to all those frustrations, too. In my work with residents, I have been involved in discussing a lot of different practice settings and even academic careers with residents who are looking for jobs specifically in internal medicine. And I have been amazed, particularly over the past year, about the flexibility that's available for women and men residents in internal medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of practices, private practices, are happy to have someone who wants to work less than full-time.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, as I have been trying to work out something that works for my husband and me with our schedules in academic medicine, I have been really impressed about the support that I've had from my department chair and from my division chief about options that are less than full-time for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think also something that's unique about my job in particular, and I think other jobs in academic internal medicine, is the flexibility. And so we have lots of roles, some of them administrative and some of them clinical, and a lot of those time commitments can be flexible. And so it's been really helpful to be able to, you know, move meetings around or do things a little bit differently so that I can be home with my daughter when she's sick in the morning, and then my husband can go home when she's sick in the afternoon. And I actually feel like I have a really flexible career. I just think as the residents have been looking, particularly this year, there are just so many opportunities open to them. So they even, you know, the residents even approach a practice and who may not be looking for someone part-time, but ask if that's an option, and everyone's had really positive feedback.
Okay. The issue of assertiveness is kind of tricky for women. Women are encouraged to be assertive and have to be in certain fields. But yet, if you're too assertive or aggressive, a woman can seem, you know, difficult or demanding. Dr. Parker, what has your experience been with this?
Well, I think, you know, those discussions, I think, have been going on a long time, first of all. You know, not just 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Did you feel at all hesitant when you first started out?
I'll be honest. I sort of went at this, and I think this may have changed. I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear what the others think about this, because they are more recently through this and closer to the ground in it. But the path I chose was to try to train hard and well and to be able to, and I use the term buy my flexibility. I felt like I bought the flexibility I was able to have based on the fact that I was well credentialed.
Mm-hmm.
And I always would choose something I could do and try to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried not to overbite.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd try not to take on more than I could deliver on well. so that I would always be desirable.
Okay.
It was actually sort of a strategic thing on my own part, you know, so I would work hard, credential, train hard, try to do well, thinking I could always use that to be somebody who could get what I wanted. I've known a lot of women, and I have a lot of my closest friends are professionals in other fields that are also in their 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be kind of an interesting common strategy a lot of us had.
Mm-hmm.
That was how we went after it. And I think that's because when we were coming along, we didn't have people telling us, don't worry, there are lots of flexible options out there. So we had to strategize how we could make them available to us. That's a big shift. If now you're able to tell people, don't worry,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are lots of options out there. I don't think I lived like I believed that, if I look back.
Okay.
You know, mine was more a strategy to figure out how to make it happen. Whereas now it sounds like that's pretty wonderful. Now what we can tell people is, hey, there are a lot of people out there who are totally tuned into this. I didn't feel that, you know, when I was coming along. So that's really good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I think I always worried that if I wasn't careful, I would end up being trapped.
Right.
You know? And so I sort of strategized to make that not happen.
Okay. Dr. Hingle, have you had any experiences where someone reacted negatively to you being assertive, or, you know, what are your general
mm-hmm.
thoughts on it?
I think in general, actually, being assertive is handled better
mm-hmm.
than when you think of sort of the traditional stereotypes, the men are assertive and the women are pushovers.
Right.
And I would say that, not that this happens often, but occasionally when I've gotten emotional in discussions, that's harder for other people to deal with than
right.
when you're assertive. Have I ever had the experience where being assertive has not been well taken? Yes. Is it because I'm a female? That I'm not sure. Sometimes I suspect that it might be. Other times I may suspect that it's just the person on the receiving end, that it's their problem and not really
okay.
anything in what I did. And when that happens, I just try to step back and think of if there's a different way I could present the point that I'm trying to make.
Okay.
But in general, I think that actually assertiveness is looked favorably upon, and being overly emotional is harder for people to deal with in women than assertiveness.
Your experience, was this with a patient or with a colleague?
Colleague.
And so from that experience that you had, you said you sort of learned how to, you sort of took it and thought about it a little bit, but you didn't really change too
much. Right, just maybe the way I worded something or the way I, you know, perhaps it was the way I reacted instead of the other person reacting.
Okay. Dr. Reimer?
You know, I'm still working on my communication skills, and I'm not sure that that's a function of my gender, but I think as, you know, we learn to interact with patients and we learn to interact with peers and other people with whom we work, we all have communication skills to learn. And I admittedly have had to learn to be a little bit more assertive as I've become more involved in some administrative roles.
Okay.
And so I was trying to think of where I've learned that. So I've read, and I've had a couple mentors specifically whose communication skills I respect, in one man and one woman. So I don't know that it is gender related, but I do think that communication skills are something that are fluid and that we continue to learn about. Specifically in internal medicine and specifically in primary care, I think communication with patients and families mm-hmm. is important. You know, as the patient-centered medical home becomes a more reality, I think, you know, communication with other health caregivers and other members of the healthcare team is particularly important.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, communication with non-physician leaders in the field is important
mm-hmm.
At this time when there are potentially a lot of changes happening in the way that medical care is delivered.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The other thing I would add to that, listening to them, is that, you know, I think as more women have become a part of the infrastructure of, you know, care teams, academic teams, you know, anything around patient care, I do think that there is a greater emphasis on getting the voice of everybody at the table heard.
Okay.
I see that so much on different kinds of committees and different kind. You know, that has really shifted. You know, I can remember so many committees where I was the only female on there. And now, you know, there are several women on a lot of these.
Right.
Know? The ones who are full professor get put on more committees. We get tagged a lot. But it's amazing as you fill these committees more at how many, and I hear that sort of in the voice of what these others are saying, you know, the sort of the need to feel like not only is it important to put your voice out there, but it's important to hear the voice of the people who may be a little less willing to put it out there. And so I think that's one of the wonderful things about having, you know, care teams at any level, committees, patient care, administrative, educational, research, whatever, you know, the richness of really trying to bring the voices of everybody involved to the table. So I think a lot of women are, you know, bring that with them, which is great because, you know,
and
I don't think it's exclusive to women, but I do feel like I hear that more. And I think the other thing is, I mean, you've heard all of us use this term about flexibility and, you know, what it offers and its importance and all of that. I think the other question is, you know, what role does our seeking, valuing flexibility have in being able to achieve a leadership position?
Okay.
And I think it's true. Maybe you don't want one. Maybe, you know, you don't want it because there isn't that flexibility. I think somebody made that point earlier. But I do think, you know, the question is, if you're someone who values that and has chosen that and see that as essential to who you are and how you are, you know, what role does that play in where you end up? And that's still playing out. That's a song that's still being written.
Right.
This is Karen Sue Blattman. I was just joining in late. And
Oh, hi.
I wanted to add, as a resident, it's been great to see, I think it is important to see all the women that are in the positions now, because since my time as a medical student, I got to see the first board chair of ACP. ACP recently had a woman president. They certainly sit on the RRC right now. We have a woman chair, and it's very interesting watching how people lead in that regard compared to their male colleagues.
This is Dr. Blattman. She's joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Do you want to give us just a quick overview?
Well, I'm still a resident, so I'm finishing up a pretty busy residency. I'm in my last year of internal medicine residency. I kind of came about medicine a little bit in a different way. I got a bachelor's in journalism and was a newspaper journalist, and most recently was at the Boston Globe before going back to school and did my medical training at University of Iowa, where I was home for me. I grew up in Ames, Iowa. And I'm married to a maternal fetal medicine specialist, and so it's interesting that I actually always thought I could do anything, but now with a family I've realized part of the decision, I'm going to be starting allergy immunology fellowship at Northwestern in July, and part of it was that I've realized that by being married to someone who still does in-house call, that I actually have to be the more flexible one, and I've now found a subspecialty that I'm hoping to give me more flexibility.
We were talking earlier about the work, you know, family balance and making the choice to go into medicine and so on and so forth. And I think you had told me that you have a three-year-old.
I have a three-year-old. I had him in the, during my fourth year of medical school, and I'm actually 10 weeks pregnant with
pregnant,
my second one.
And you're a resident. How are you balancing everything?
Well, I have a great husband. He actually chose to leave a excellent institution. He was had been at Mass General for 10 years and was willing to come down to a place where I found, which was much more family friendly, and he's actually gone part-time so I can finish out residency. Otherwise, we weren't going to be able to make this happen.
Right.
Because right now, I do so much call, and and he still has to do a fair amount of call, that when I have weekends that are free, that's when he puts in his call, and his department has been really very good about it. It's interesting that for the last couple months he's actually had to go full-time, and we've kind of realized this, how stressful it's been for both of us to be full-time and to not have any family around, and we've realized that it's actually not doable for us to be both full-time.
Dr. Parker was telling us earlier about how interesting it's been to see the changes that have been taking place as more and more women have been going into medicine, and she was talking about how she used to be the only woman at the table, you know, at meetings, and now it's half and half. And I think you're the youngest. What do you think, do you think discrimination is still a problem at all?
You know, I don't think it's an issue of discrimination. I think what it is this time off the clock, and that if you're able to go through and be able to do things at a full-time basis and do everything you want to do and still be able to have a family, I think it's really tough. And I think that that's what's, I don't know if it's really discrimination is that there's not the ability to be able to, if you're going to have a child in those first few years, it's really difficult. I think that's the issue. And what's interesting to me is that my husband has actually gotten a ton more flack from being at Harvard Medical School to now being a part-time dad and working, you know, at, you know, maybe a less prestigious place, you know, whatever you want to call it. But he's fulfilled in being able to do the teaching and the clinical stuff, but also being able to take care of the family. And that's allowed me to be full-time in residency and to do additional things that I've enjoyed doing, such as being on the RRC. There is no way I would be able to do this if I had a husband who couldn't take that kind of time off.
Right. And that's interesting what you say, that he actually catches more flack because now that men are becoming more involved in raising families, you know, it's being, you know, the stay-at-home dad is more and more common these days.
And I think that this is my generation. They're very interested in, they've seen all these parents that are divorced, and we were the latchkey kids, and I think that really these husbands are very interested in being a part of their families and are willing to, I think we're going to see more and more of this.
And we also were talking earlier about how the workplace in general is much more flexible, and how women have a lot more freedom now in their choices, and how that's a good thing. Okay.
I think the caveat in that is still traditional academia with full tenureship, and, you know, sort of the rank and file of the big hallways. I don't know the data now, but maybe somebody else does. But, I mean, I think as you hear people talking, these are important things, and I'm going to do it this way, and I think that's great. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, being happy and longevity and probably being able to be a good doctor and a good person and a good parent and all these things that you value. I think it's great. And I would be the first to say there are only so many hours in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to realize that. I mean, it's so simple, but it actually took me a long time to realize you can only do so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, a couple can only do so much. And a family, parents can only do so much.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to figure out what you really are going to do and how you're going to make it happen. And I think it's just fabulous to see families going at this as two parents. I mean, that's so critically important. I used to say the only book I could write would be on childcare. I mean, I can make people bust their sides and stitches at the things over the years that I have learned and done in childcare. And a lot of other women can too. You know, just on it, and the people that I've gotten to know because of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the services and the people who ran them and what you do when. And I mean, but most of us who've had to figure it out, you somehow figure it out.
Right.
But it's, you know, at the end of the day, what really matters is feeling good about, you know, your kids and your family and what you're doing, and realizing you can only do so much.
Right.
And that's you know, but I didn't start out realizing that.
Okay.
I grew into it.
So this is Christy Reimer. I just have one more comment on that. It's funny because we just had this conversation yesterday in the hall with one of my colleagues here that I think by the nature of the profession we're in, most of us are used to giving 100% and 100% of our time to what we want to do and what we're good at, and that's medicine. And then particularly when you have a child, that changes because you want to give 100% of the hours in your day to your child and your family, and you want to give 100% of the hours in your day to your career and your job. And that's, I think that's a hard lesson learned by a lot of people in our profession, that you just can't give all of your hours to more than one thing.
Right.
That's a frequent topic of conversation. A lesson that we all eventually learn.
I do think, Karen Sue Blattman, I do think that promotion tenure is going to still be the last issue, because I know that at UVA we only have 3 women full professors, which is amazing to me because we have a lot of assistant and associate professors. There's plenty of women. They're just not, you know, I don't know what are the rules and all that sort of stuff, but it's interesting to me that there's clearly something going on still that's a barrier, because why we have so few full professors.
Do you have any ideas, any guesses?
My guess is still that the issue of when you're having kids and the time that's required to produce so much in a certain amount of time, if you take a break and you're not allowed to come off the clock, then
right.
That time lapses and you don't have enough papers published to move on to the next. But that's my only guess. I don't know it. I don't understand it well enough yet.
I think some of it, too, though, is also just the absolute numbers. Again, I think we'll find out, you know, within the next 10 years or so, now that there are a lot more women in medicine than there used to be. You know, the numbers were just so few before. And when I look here, the people who are full professors are people who are a generation before me. You know, when there weren't a lot of females going into medicine in general. So some of it, I think, may be related to just the mere numbers of females who are at that, you know, achievable level.
Okay. Is this Dr. Hengel?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Dr. Reimer, have you sounded off on this yet, or?
I guess I haven't contributed to this conversation about promotion and tenure. So I think the time and the timing of having kids and being productive in a career is certainly a factor. The other thing is that there are still a reasonable number of women who leave academics earlier in their career, and I don't know why that is all the time, but I think frequently people are looking for career options that may have a little bit different flexibility as far as time management and scheduling and things like that. So I think in addition to the fact that, you know, there are a lot of younger physicians who may not have matriculated into the upper levels of academia, there are, and that eventually that will happen, likely, but there are still a significant number of women who are leaving, and I don't know why that is. But I think that contributes to the reason we don't see a lot of women in the full professor positions.
Okay. Now, but Dr. Parker, you are a professor of medicine where you are, correct?
I am. I am not on the tenure track. I'm on the clinical track.
Was it difficult for you to get to that position?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. It's such an individual thing on one level. There are metrics there. And I think for the tenure track, you know, the problem is that it's not the same. It differs by, the standards are different at different institutions. What's true at one is not going to be the same in another one. The tracks aren't even the same across schools. But in general, I think, you know, the comments that you've heard about, the metrics that are in place for promotion and tenure really are just beginning to try to figure out what to do with the fact that more and more people, and I think it's women and men, it's still predominantly women, but there are men joining the ranks as well, are saying, I need to be able to make some choices here that contribute to, you know, my life outside of medicine, and I don't want to be, you know, I still want to be able to progress within your system.
Right.
And I want to be recognized as a valuable contributor, you know, an employer within your system. And that's still an issue, you know, and it's grappled with on all levels. And all of us know, I think, I mean, it's tough because there's some people who do give 100+% of everything. And you do what you can, you do the best you can, and yet there may be somebody that's on the same level working 1.5, 2.5 times as much for the same kind of thing, and they don't have some of the same other obligations. It's tough. But on the other hand, I think if what we value is a community, and I use that word fairly loosely, but if what you value is an institution that says we want to reflect diversity. We don't all want to look just alike. We don't all want to be just alike. We want to embrace and value the following attributes. And that's where I think the leadership sets that and makes those hard decisions. And, you know, I think that's where, as voices at the table really interject sort of meaningful metrics into the conversation, mm-hmm. we begin to see some shifts. And I think some of that comes from having, you know, people, women in leadership roles and men in leadership roles who have had sometimes their eyes opened in a personal way to what a broader view really can mean for the whole. It's hard when you're fairly traditional and you've always been one way. And medicine, I think, as a profession, is fairly slow to evolve. I think we're a pretty, you know, traditional, slow-moving profession. You know, an example I'll give you that I always loved hearing people talk about was Donna Shalala. Donna Shalala, I loved it. Donna Shalala used to sit in big committee meetings with her big position in D.C. and say, oh, this is an important committee. Make sure you put a woman on there who, in addition to working carpools.
Can I ask you who she is?
Donna Shalala was head of HHS.
Okay.
And now she's head of University of Miami.
Okay.
And, you know, that's great. I mean, that's unbelievable because what she was saying was, if I have a woman who's working and doing all this stuff and she's carpooling, she'll know how to figure this out. And I had heard her say that a couple of times at big national meetings. Well, that's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. We don't hear that a lot.
Okay.
So that's just one example, but that was great for me to hear, somebody who could rise to those ranks and say that. I mean, that's pretty empowering.
Speaking of that, I was going to ask all of you if you've had a female mentor professionally that's made a difference for you. I'll start with Dr. Hingle.
I actually have not, and that's one thing. When earlier you were asking Dr. Parker about what she really liked about her job, and that's one of the things that I feel very fortunate to be able to provide to my students and residents is mentorship and really understanding what they're going through, because that's one thing. I've had excellent mentors throughout my career so far, very supportive mentors, but to this point in time, they've really all been males. And I feel like it probably would have made things a little bit easier had I had a, you know, strong female mentor.
Well, what was one of the most important things that you learned from them?
I actually learned different things from different mentors.
You say you enjoy, you know, teaching some of these things to your students now. You probably, I imagine, repeat the same things, or you've learned to incorporate their advice into, you know, your own job, and then maybe you're sort of passing it on as well.
Right. And I think one of the things that's important in academics is to realize that most of our students and residents aren't going to go into academics. They're going to go into, you know, different settings that I'm practicing in.
Okay.
So that's important to think about when you are giving them advice. But some of the things that I've learned from my mentors is to really find your passion and to pursue that, and that's what's going to keep you fulfilled. To be flexible, you know, be willing to change and to not be locked into one mindset. Another important thing that I've learned from mentors is to learn how to say no, and I think this is something that Dr. Parker was alluding to. You're going to be most effective when you aren't overwhelmed and you're able to fully put forth your effort into the projects that you have.
Right.
And that's been a difficult thing for me to learn, and I don't know if it is gender-related. You read all these books and articles about how it's harder for women to say no than it is to men. So that may be a gender thing, and that may be some area where having had a strong female mentor might have made an impact. Because when I started out my career in academics, you know, I said yes to everything. I didn't know I could say no.
Right.
And I, you know, got way in over my head and had too many things going on. And then finally, actually it was having kids that allowed me in my mind to say, it's okay to say no.
Right.
I need to say no. But when it was just really work, it was difficult. That was something that was really hard for me.
Dr. Reimer, did you have a female mentor? Who?
I did. I was lucky enough to have Donna Sweet, who is well known in the ACP circles, as one of my faculty as a resident, and then I worked with her as a junior faculty peer after I finished residency for 5 years. And so she was probably my first career mentor, and she was great, and I've learned so much from her, from things ranging from patient care and really always putting the patient first to, like I had mentioned before, you know, communication skills and how to deal with some administrative things that I hadn't dealt with before. But additionally, it's something that I always talk to students and residents to is having multiple mentors. And so I, you know, no one else is in the same exact situation as I am ever. And so I also have mentors, you know, different mentors since I've had a baby about how to, you know, manage taking care of my child and manage vomiting through my pregnancy and working at the same time. And,
right.
And people who've given me, you know, great advice about that. And I have other mentors, men and women, who I continue to go to when I'm faced with questions or problems that I don't quite know how to address. So I feel really lucky. I've had great mentors.
Dr. Blattman, how about you?
No, I don't think I have a specific, like the others, maybe not a specific mentor. I've been able to encounter a lot of different people and been able to kind of tailor it to the specific questions I'm interested in. And I think partly for me it's being around a lot of great people and, you know, encountering people like Donna Sweet when I was involved in ACP and just, you know, they may have not been someone that I have stayed long-term in touch with, but just being around them and kind of getting kind of a, you know, one thing that's really helped me is hearing people's stories and kind of how they've gotten to where they are and taking kind of some of those, thinking about those stories and taking some of those lessons from various people and kind of making them personal to me have been probably the most helpful.
Okay, we're running out of time. I just want to ask one last question of each of you. If you were talking to a younger colleague, medical student, woman, and she asked you, you know, what advice can you give me? Just a takeaway piece of advice, what would it be? I'll start with Dr. Parker.
Boy, I had one yesterday, and I told her, have fun. Don't take it too seriously.
Right.
You know, enjoy yourself and laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And have fun. Find the joy. You know, whether, and I think that's the key to it all. And if it's all right there for you and whatever you're doing in the practice of medicine, that's great. If that's not all that you need to find it, then open yourself up and find it in the other things and put these all together. That to me is what the balance really is about. But, boy, I couldn't do any of it. I mean, I like to laugh. I like to have fun. So have
right.
fun.
Dr. Hengel?
I think mine would be fairly similar. I would say to find your passion and to allow yourself to be a full person and not just a doctor.
Dr. Reimer?
That's a hard question because I actually feel the same way. And so in addition to recommending that people find their passion and decide what makes them happy, that I try to encourage people to find multiple passions and work to be able to do all those things that make them happy and make them a whole person.
And Dr. Blattman?
Probably echo something similar. I remember when I ended up telling my husband I was going to be going to medical school, changing my career and going to medical school, he said, well, you know, the problem is the way the system is that you take all these really fascinating people that apply to medical school and you make them into very boring people.
because they're so busy with kind of probably trying to, you know, do the right thing to get in and go up the ladder and work in the training. And I do think it echoes kind of what everyone else has said, is that, you know, life is more than just work, and that you do have to kind of find the things that you're interested in doing, and you know, not picking the specialty that's most prestigious, but go back and think, is this something I'm going to be happy for the rest of my life? And then the balance of family. And it's true. I thought I could, my time was, there was no limit to my time until I had my first child. And, you know, now everything is kind of in balance and doing all the things I want to do, but also to make sure that I have enough time for my husband and my child.
Well, we've come to the end of our time. I'd like to thank all of you for participating today. We hope this discussion has been productive for all of you, and hopefully it'll serve as a useful reference for all of our listeners as well. More information and resources for Women in Medicine are available on our website, acponline.org. And again, thanks to our panelists, Dr. Parker, Dr. Hengel, Dr. Reimer, and Dr. Blattman. We appreciate your participation and your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.